It's time to get spooky. Welcome to the show. Let's go.
Hello, and welcome back to the Spooky Scary Podcast. My name is Kat.
And my name is Chris.
And today we're going to get sad.
Yeah, this is going to be a more depressing of an episode.
I'm like, should we be like a little haha funny beforehand? Because it's not going to be haha funny when we're actually telling the stories.
Yeah, no, it's very much not. But then I'm kind of
like, maybe we should just jump into it because I feel like we kind of came here with an agenda today.
Yeah, this is, yeah, we're not haha funny today. We're serious adults today, which is very difficult for either of us to do, but
yeah,
we will do our best.
Yeah, so Chris texted me after we recorded our last episode, because since then and now, Biden has become the president.
What a wonderful thing that is.
I was, like, so surprised that the inauguration just went off, like, so easily.
I know, I was too, and, like, the entire day I was at work, and I'm like, this just feels extremely surreal. Like, this isn't happening.
It felt fake. Like, I was like, I don't, like, I'm not, like, one of these QAnon people, but, like, I was honestly, like, someone's gonna try to, like, assassinate him, like, something crazy's gonna happen. Like, I just felt like something bad was gonna happen.
Well, did you see that, like, literally, like, that night? Someone posted on Twitter, like, I just drafted articles of impeachment against President Joseph Biden. And, like,
yeah, and I was
for
like,
what, bro? What? It's been 12 why? Hours.
I think their thing is they're, like, because his son, like, is a Russian, like, I don't know what the fuck. Something about his laptop. I don't fucking know.
Yes, impeach him for his laptop.
His son's laptop.
Even better. What a good reason to
impeach the
sitting
president. I think, like,
they think
he's, like, in the mafia or something.
Of course he is.
It's some, like, dumb conspiracy. Or maybe it's true. I honestly don't know. It was something like there was a guy who, Joe Biden's son, like, brought in the laptop and to, like, a laptop repair shop. And the guy, I don't know what exactly the story is. He somehow... Oh, I think it was that they never came to pick it back up, and after, like, a certain amount of days, that's considered surrendered property.
Yeah.
So he never came to pick the laptop back up, so it became surrendered property, so he, like, went into it, and then he found that it was Hunter Biden's laptop, and he said that he, like, found a bunch of stuff, like, connecting him to, like, crime or something.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I'm kind of like, I mean, I don't know. I struggle.
Well, we all love a good wacky conspiracy, so tune in next week. Well, we'll be talking about wacky conspiracies because we need a nice break after what we're going to get into this week.
Yes, today we are talking about the death penalty in multiple forms.
Yes.
So, yeah, the reason that I was like, oh, this is going to be a sad episode is because basically Chris texted me the other day, and you guys might remember, people were talking a lot about the federal death row because Trump's administration killed more federally, like, people on federal death row than any administration since, who
like
was
what,
it? Like, Nixon
the 60s,
or though?
Like, it was, like, the 60s, right?
Yeah. I think he killed 17 people on death row in the year. And a lot of them were, like, I'm not trying to be, like, oh, these people were 100% innocent. I mean, they might have been, like, I don't, you know, like, wrongful executions happen, which
exactly.
I'm going to talk about later. But, like, I don't know. I think we've talked about this before, how I'm just, like, I'm not, like, vehemently against the death penalty. Like, I feel like some people maybe, like, Dylan Roof or, like, people who are, like, the Parkland shooter or something like that, like, maybe, but also I just feel like logically it doesn't really make sense, and I feel like the death penalty is mostly something that people pursue out of vengeance, not so much out of any, like, real, this is for the good.
Yeah, and it's like, you know?
Like, there's no positive. I feel like it's just getting your own retribution.
Right. There's no justice in that. Like, there's no justice that's served by doing that. You're not righting any of the wrongs they did. You're not changing any of the actions that they did. You're not any better than they are. Like, you're doing something just as bad.
Exactly. And it's like, even if you don't think it's bad, like, I'm not, you know, with a lot of people who are, like, mass murderers or something and end up on death row, I'm not so much, like, gonna, you know, like, their life is not the hill I'm gonna die on. I'm not, like, fighting for, like, their rights. Or, I mean, I do think prisoners have rights and should have rights, but, like, I'm not, like, oh my god, poor babies, they don't deserve the death penalty. That's not where I'm coming from. I just feel like, logically, it doesn't make sense. And then in the case of some of the people who are on federal death row, like, I should have done better research before getting on this, but I don't remember their names, but I know there was one man who was involved in, I think it was an attempted robbery, and it ended with the person he was with, like, killing these two people, and then he disposed of their bodies, like, by burning them. And that's not good, obviously. Like, if... I mean, I don't know all the facts of the case. Obviously, I said I didn't really research this. I'm just kind of talking off of what I had read in, like, articles and stuff. Just so that one person who said I'm poorly researched doesn't...
No, I think I was the one who was poorly researched, because I...
You were the one who was poorly researched.
Yeah, I didn't know about the 48 hours thing. And I'll admit it, I didn't. But...
Oh, I sound unintelligent because I say like too much.
Yes.
You're uninformed.
However, I made sure to be informed this week. I covered all of my bases. I even researched what some political things meant, because that kind of ties into my story a little bit.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have, like, context for where we were setting this up for.
Exactly. My actual story is well researched. My right now, where I'm just, like, talking off of the top of my head, because this is something I feel like we should talk about, is maybe the research is not spot on, I apologize, but, you know, you can look up the cases, look up the people who were executed on federal death row in the last 4 years, learn about them, but, yeah, so there was I'm not saying that, like, obviously if you, you know, are involved in a robbery and two people die and you dispose of their body and, like, burn them, that's not good. I mean, like, if you actually do that stuff, you deserve to be prosecuted for that. But, like, maybe I don't know. It just doesn't seem, like, on the same level as a lot of... The, like, level of what justifies the death penalty, I feel like, is never clearly defined. Like, if you don't actually kill people, you're just there when they die, you can end up on death row. But also, then there are people like Jeffrey Dahmer who, like, don't get the death penalty, and it's like, I get that it's, like, state by state, but it's like, what the fuck can we pick a...
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And this week's episode is less focused on the true crime aspect of everything, and more so just focused on the inadequacy of the judicial system. And so, while we are talking about true crime things and things of that nature, this is more of a serious conversation rather than our lighthearted normal selves.
It's also one thing that I need to say over and over again, because so many people think, like, anytime you talk about the death penalty, there people are always like, well, it's better supporting them with their life in prison. Everybody needs to know it costs way more to execute someone than it costs to just have them live the rest of their life in prison.
Especially with the shitty conditions that most American prisons have. Like, it's not like they're living in the lap of luxury in prison, you know?
Exactly. And, like, killing people is costly. I have a freaking thing here. Wait one second. Oh, no, I scrolled away from it. Okay, so there's this guy named Timothy McVeigh who was responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing.
Mm-hmm.
His execution cost over $13 million.
Jesus. That is not at all how much I was expecting it to be. I was expecting it to be, like, a decent number, but that is so much more than my brain was ready for.
It costs so much because, like, having a court trial costs a lot of money. You have to pay the judge, you have to pay the bailers, you have to pay, like, a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, I guess I didn't think about that.
having the courtroom and all this stuff, like, it costs money.
And then also the multiple appeals process that the majority of death row inmates go on.
Exactly. For the most part, if you get sentenced to death row, your appeal is automatically submitted. And, like, most people who are on death row, like, appeal multiple times, because I don't think there's a... I mean, like, I think you have to have new evidence to have an appeal.
There is a limit. But, yeah. I touch on it a little bit in my story.
Okay, there's a limit?
Yes.
I mean, it might go state by state, but, yeah, like, your people who get the death penalty are way more likely to appeal multiple times than somebody who just has life in prison.
Right, exactly. And so it's wasting so much less resources and time, because, like, not only is this spending money, this is also an attorney and lawyer and everything who, they're just staying in this fight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a fight that they started in the initial sentencing, and now for the next 10, 15 years, it's a fight they're now having to continue.
Yeah, and that's not even getting into, like, the morality of it, of, like, I mean, like, who are we, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously, that's, like, debatable person to person, and, like, some people are like, well, if you do a bad thing, like, you know, but, like, I don't know.
I just feel like it's too similar still to firing squads and hanging and the electric chair. Like, just because you're doing it in a more efficient method doesn't make it any less horrible.
And it's also, like, what, like, you're not gaining anything. It just seems like, it's the same thing to me as, like, you know, like, public hangings. Like, the people used to have to fight the lion in the fucking arena, like... It just seems very, like, haha, let's...
And it's not even, quench, like...
quench our thirst for blood.
It's not even, like, it brings the victims' families any closure, because oftentimes it happens 10, 15, 20 years after the crimes take place.
Yeah.
So, like, at that point, I can't speak for most, for, you know, everyone, but I'm sure at least some people have already made their peace with the situation. At that point, it's just bringing up old memories and old pain.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it also kind of, like, because there's all of those appeals trials and everything, it's, like, they can't really, like, mourn or grieve or go through that process. Because there's, like, they have to keep fucking going to court. And the question of what's going to happen to the perpetrator, like, keeps changing.
It's... Yeah. But
anyway, would you like to start telling your story?
Yes, I have to pull it up 1 second, sorry. Yes. Okay, so I'm going to be covering the murder of Bobby Joe Stinnett and in addition, the execution of Lisa Montgomery.
Okay. Is that who died recently?
Yes, just a week ago.
Okay.
Well, just over a week ago. It was on the 13th, so I forgot what day it was for a minute. Anyway, so Bobby Jo Stinnett was a pregnant 23-year-old woman. She was found murdered in her home in Skidmore, Missouri. She was strangled to death, and her unborn child that was 8 months, like, developed, was cut from her womb. Buddy, no, thank you. So Bobby Joe and Lisa met through a dog show event, and they talked to each other in an online rat terrier chat room called Ratter Chatter.
I'm obsessed with that.
I really loved that, and I wanted to highlight that because I thought that was fun.
Ratter chatter.
It's the only high point of this entire story.
Only fun part.
Yeah, so just hold on to that while I go through the rest.
Thank you for all your service, Ratter chatter.
Truly the hero of this story. But on December 16th, 2004, Lisa entered her home and strangled her, then cut the unborn child from her womb and left the scene. There was no sign of forced entry, so...
She knew it was someone she knew.
Yeah. She was found by her mother, Becky, lying in a pool of blood about an hour after the murder happened. She called the authorities and described the wounds and said it looked as though her stomach had exploded.
Jesus Christ.
They found the baby the next day thanks to an Amber Alert.
Mm-hmm.
The alert was initially denied because it had never been used before in the case of an unborn child.
Oh, okay.
Because there you couldn't have any description of the victim or anything like that.
Yeah.
So, but a local congressman got involved and the alert was put in place.
Mm-hmm.
When they went to speak to Lisa, they found her in her living room holding the baby, watching TV with the Amber Alert on the TV. And then DNA testing confirmed that it was the baby.
Yeah.
So I just want
to... How do you put out... I mean, I'm not... I'm just trying to imagine an Amber Alert for... Like, what was it? Like, not living baby?
Well, missing? No. It was alive.
The baby was alive?
Yeah. It was eight... It was, like, 8 months in the womb. So that was enough time for... Like, everything to develop. It was just a very more gruesome version of, like, an emergency section.
I guess, but I just thought, like... I don't know what I thought. I thought, like, if... Like, a baby was delivered, like, premature like that. I mean, I guess not super premature, but, like... That it wouldn't necessarily survive without, like, medical intervention?
Yeah, but, I mean... With being at 8 months, I mean, there are people who have their babies naturally at 8 months. Like, their bodies just are like, time to get out. You're evicted. Bye.
You've been evicted from the Big Brother house.
Yes. Speaking of that, did you see one of the casting people quit?
Yes. I'm very excited about that.
I'm very excited for the next season of Big Brother.
So boring.
Well, it was because CBS said that half of the cast from now on needed to be, like, an actually diverse group of people.
Yeah, because it kept being, like, they would have one, like...
Person
one
of color.
Two, like, people of color, and then they just get, like, bullied or the first people evicted. Like, it's so uncomfortable every season.
And so now they're like, we need more representation.
Yeah.
Which, like, yeah, buddy.
And I feel like that casting person was, like, kind of famously, like, anti.
Yeah, very much so. And she... Like, phrased it under the guise of new opportunities, but, like...
Yeah, she would be like, I have given you one black person, and I have given you five cowboys.
Take your pick. They're all disgusting. One of them's metrosexual.
And that's the most LGBTQ representation you will get.
That has been an unexpected rant about Big Brother. But on a much more sobering topic.
Yeah, it was some much needed levity.
Yes. We will now get into Lisa's life before the incident.
So the baby lived?
Yeah. Like, it was
good for the baby.
The father was taking care of it.
Okay.
Like, it was put under the father's protection. From what I could tell, no. I believe, like, the baby was alive and she, like, just was holding it.
Well, the reason I'm, like, curious is because I... I guess the baby is alive. I don't know why I thought, I guess I saw a bunch of people on Instagram. I follow this, like, Instagram page called Shit You Should Care About.
Yeah.
Which... is a nice page, and it posted about, you know, the executions that were taking place, and a lot of people under the picture of Lisa Montgomery were like, she killed a baby, so I just, like, assumed that she killed the baby.
Yeah, a lot of people, this is the reason I wanted to do this specific case, is because there's a lot of mixed feelings about this, because I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to argue what she did isn't horrible. Mm-hmm. However, the details I'm about to get into from her life and the subsequent testimonies from, like, psychologists and other physicians, it just... This woman deserved to, like, answer for what she did, but not with her life.
I also would like to update, the baby is alive. Her name is Victoria Jo, and she turned 16 last month.
Aw, well, that's another good news from this story. So, Lisa Marie Montgomery was born on February 27th, 1968. Mm-hmm. She was raised in Malvern, Kansas. She was raised in an abusive home where she was allegedly raped by her stepfather and his friends and physically beaten from the age of 11.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this abuse, she quickly turned to alcoholism. And, like, so she's 11 years old and already
an alcoholic,
yeah. When she was 14, her mother discovered the abuse and threatened her daughter with a gun.
Love that, when you find out that your child is being abused and you are mad at the child for it.
Yeah. She attempted to escape her abusive family by marrying when she turned 18, but both her first and second marriage resulted in further abuse.
Yeah, I feel like that's such a thing. Like, people get stuck in these patterns of abuse.
Yeah. She had four children before she underwent a tubal ligation, which is, you know, just getting your tubes tied. It's just the medical term for it.
Mm-hmm.
In 1990. After that procedure, she claimed multiple times to be pregnant, according to both her first and second husbands.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of her arrest, it was speculated that her motivation stemmed from a miscarriage that she may have suffered.
Okay.
I
feel like whenever you tell these stories, I react like you're a detective, and I too am a detective, and you're briefing me on the details. I'm like, okay, how do we catch this person?
What's my next step?
Yeah.
She was charged with the federal offense of kidnapping resulting in death, a crime that was first established by the Federal Kidnapping Code, or Federal Kidnapping Act of 1932. Sorry, there was a code right below it, and my brain jumped.
Mm-hmm.
If convicted, she faced a sentence of life imprisonment or the death penalty. At a pretrial hearing, a neuropsychologist testified that head injuries, which she had sustained a few years prior, could have damaged the part of her brain that controls aggression. During her trial in federal court, her defense attorneys, led by Frederick Duchard?
Duchard.
Yeah, that sounds a lot better than what I said.
I don't know if I'm right. You just gotta say it like you mean it.
That's fair. He's probably he's listening to this and just shaking his head at me. Said that she had pseudocyesis, which is a mental condition that causes a woman to falsely believe she is pregnant and exhibit outward symptoms of pregnancy.
Like a cryptid pregnancy.
Yeah. According to the Guardian, he attempted to follow this line of defense only one...
I think I meant to say cryptic pregnancy, but I said cryptid pregnancy.
Yeah, I didn't know what you meant, but I was like, I'm gonna just go with it, because I don't want to sound stupid, because maybe that's a thing.
No, it was that fuck the Mothman meme earlier. I guess it got in my head, we're having a cryptid pregnancy.
Oh no. Oh no.
Terrifying. That... Nightmares.
Yeah. Sorry, I lost my spot. So yeah, he attempted to follow this line of defense only 1 week before the trial began, after being forced to abandon a contradictory argument, that the girl who was murdered by Lisa's brother, Tommy, but he had an alibi. So they were like, dude, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this, Lisa's family refused to cooperate and described her background to the jury. Like, they were just like, I'm not going to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. V.S. Ramachandran and Dr. William Logan gave testimony that Montgomery had pseudocyesis in addition to depression, BPD, and PTSD. They testified that her stories about her actions fluctuated because of her delusional state and that she was unable to dictate the nature and quality of her acts. Mm-hmm. However, the federal prosecutor and expert witness forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz disagreed with the diagnosis of pseudocyesis. But, like, didn't say anything about the other three, just the pseudocyesis. So, like, on October 22nd, 2007, jurors found her guilty, rejecting the defense claim that she was delusional. On October 26th, the jury recommended the death penalty.
I don't understand why the jury can, like... I get that, like, the whole idea is, like, a jury before your peers, like, they decide what's true and what's not, etc. But, like, I don't understand how a medical person could be like, this person suffers from delusions, and the jury can just be like, I don't think so.
Well, because another doctor said they didn't.
Okay.
Well, the other doctor said they didn't have pseudocyesis, but I don't know if maybe they also were trying to, like, insinuate the other things weren't real. Like, well, if this one's not true, then maybe the other ones aren't, type of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But on April 4th, 2008, Judge Gary Fenner sentenced her to death officially. The pseudocyesis defense, her past trauma, and separate diagnosis of mental illnesses were not fully revealed to the jury by her appeals team until after her conviction. So then people started to say that she was given incompetent legal defense.
Mm-hmm.
But the judge required that one of her defense attorneys be cross-examined in November 2016.
Mm-hmm.
But he rejected all criticism and said that he, like, stands by his actions.
I know, like, it doesn't make sense for... a defense attorney to do this, but what if, like, a defense attorney was like, not, you're guilty, and just, like, makes it their, like, job to sabotage you?
Like, I don't fucking care.
Sometimes
if I get paid.
Sometimes it feels like that's happening, like, my freaking story later, I'm like, that defense attorney, I'll talk about it when I talk about it.
Fun little tidbit that doesn't actually matter to anything, but the journalists in The Guardian who said that the defense attorney was incompetent was David Rose, mm-hmm. which I just found fun because, you know, David Rose from the show. God damn it. Sorry. I lost my spot again. I'm bad at this. On March 19th, 2012, the Supreme Court denied Lisa's petition. She was registered for the Federal Bureau of Prisons under number 110720031. She was incarcerated at Federal Medical Center Carswell in Fort Worth, Texas. And that is where she stayed up until when she was transferred to site of her execution.
Mm-hmm. And when you were reading off the numbers, I was just like, 24601, let's go.
Yep, that one.
No, all he did was steal some bread.
She was also one of the only women with a federal death sentence for a very long time. Like, over the course of history, there's not been many women who have been executed. I will touch on them in a minute.
I think she's the only woman who's been executed in the last 70 years.
67 years.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I
read around it.
I knew I typed it somewhere, so I just scrolled down real quick to see that one part, but I will touch on it, and I will briefly touch on the other women who've been executed. Experts who examined her after conviction concluded that by the time of her crime, she had long been living with psychosis, bipolar disorder, and PTSD. She was said to be often dissociated from reality and to have permanent brain damage from numerous beatings at the hands of her parents and former spouses.
Mm-hmm.
She was scheduled for execution on December 8th, 2020, but this was delayed after her attorney contracted COVID.
I forgot how freaking recent this is.
I know. On December 23rd, 2020, she was given a new execution date of January 12th, 2021. U.S. District Court Judge Randolph Moss found that, quote, the director's order setting a new execution date while the court's stay was in effect was not in accordance with the law, prohibiting the rescheduling of the execution before January 1st, 2021. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court denied a last-ditch effort by her defense attorneys, who argued that she should have been given a competency hearing to prove her severe mental illness, which would have made her ineligible for the death penalty. She was the 11th federal death row inmate to be executed by the Trump administration after a 17-year hiatus in federal executions. And on January 1st... Oh, I already talked about that. Sorry. I wrote that twice and then forgot to delete it. On January 12th, she arrived in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is their death row. Mm-hmm. She was executed by lethal injection on January 13th, 2021 at the United States Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. When asked if she had any last words, she said no. She was pronounced dead at 1:31 a.m. In a statement from her attorney, she said, quote, "The government stopped at nothing in its zeal to kill this damaged and delusional woman. Lisa Montgomery's execution was far from justice."
I feel like... ugh. It's just like... I feel like it's rough, because I think people think that if you are like, oh, this person shouldn't have been executed, or just like the death penalty in general is wrong, or like if you talk about how they had like a past of abuse or a past of mental illness or something, they think you're like saying that like they don't deserve justice.
Right, like they're like you're making excuses for them. But like, no, we're not saying that they don't deserve some sort of repercussions.
Yeah.
But someone who isn't mentally aware of the gravity of their actions isn't going to be mentally aware of the gravity of their sentence.
I also think it's like, I think a lot of people want to like live in this like black and white world, but like the truth is that we don't. Like, we live in a lot of different shades of gray, and the fact of the matter is that you can say, yes, it is awful and horrible what she did, and she deserves to, you know, she's a danger to people around her, and she does need to, you know, something needs to happen so she's not just like roaming the streets, because obviously she killed someone and she tried to kidnap a baby. Like, that's a awful thing, and justice should be served for that. But you can say that, and you can also say, isn't it fucked up that this woman was abused her entire life, had a bunch of mental illnesses, and, you know, it got to the point where she was doing these awful things, and no one intervened and helped her if she was having these intense delusions, and that a court then decided to sentence her to death despite her mental illnesses. And like, you can say both of those things, and both of those things can be true at the same time.
Right. And like, she could have still gotten the help she needed while also being punished for the things she did.
Yeah. And I think it's also like, it shouldn't, at least for me, maybe other people can disagree and that's fine, but I feel like prison shouldn't be about punishment. It should be about what is best for society. Obviously, people who are running around murdering people cannot just be left to their own devices without supervision, because that is bad for society. They will hurt people. They will kill people. But, like, killing them doesn't do anything positive. Like, it's just, like, punish. And it's like, well, if punishment is what you care about, that's fine, but at least admit that you're here for vengeance. You're not, like, don't try to pretend you're like, oh, this is just what's good for the world, because there's it's not like a positive. It's just
not only that, like, revenge. Prisons aren't meant to just be viewed as punishment. The idea of a prison is rehabilitation. Like, not everyone going to prison is there forever, and the point, like, the idea is that they're supposed to go in there and get better, and like whatever's, they get help with whatever's like ailing them, basically. Mm-hmm. But instead it's like a 20-year nightmare.
And it's also like, I don't know, I always feel like weird when I hear about situations like this where it's like, it's sad all around. And same with like Eileen Wuornos that we talked about a few weeks ago, where it's like, obviously, like, they killed people, that is bad, but people are kind of driven by this anger, and it's like I could never understand what that's like. I've never had a loved one be murdered, thank God. So obviously I don't understand that anger, and I'm sure the last thing that you are ever feeling is any sort of empathy for the person who did that. So like I get that anger, but I also think sometimes that anger, it's just not productive.
Right. No, I agree.
Because like I hear a lot about like families of victims being very like, no, they need to get the death penalty, or like they, if like an appeal is filed or if somebody, evidence comes forward that maybe this person is innocent, they're always like, no, they're not innocent. And it's like, but what if they are? Don't you want to find the person who actually did it?
Right. Like, wouldn't you want to know without a shadow of a doubt that the person who did this horrible thing to your family, like, they got the actual person responsible for it?
Yeah, but it's like, I mean, I can understand maybe they just want the nightmare to be over, but it's like, well, do you care more about that, or do you care more about the truth?
Right. Because at that point, it's not really a matter of justice, you just want the whole thing to be over with. Which, like, I get, yeah, too, like, you know, you don't want to have to keep reliving it, like I talked about that earlier, but is it fair for someone to pay for it with their life, especially like in some cases when they didn't even do anything? Which I know, yeah, you'll, I touch on, like, mm-hmm, in yours
in a bit. Well, do you want to take a break?
I actually have a few more now? Things to say. Sorry, I wasn't, oh, okay, done with my story.
No, you're fine. I'm sorry. No, it's, I thought, okay, you were done. No. And I was just like, time for me to talk.
But she became the first female federal prisoner executed in 67 years. And the first woman executed in the United States since Kelly Gissender in 2015. And the first person executed in the U.S. in 2021. Only three other women have been executed by the U.S. federal government. In 1865, Mary Surratt was executed by hanging. In 1953, Ethel Rosenberg by electric chair. And also in 1953, Bonnie Heady by gas chamber.
Gas chamber.
Yeah. Lisa's, what, execution was followed 1 day later by Corey Johnson, and 3 days later by Dustin Higgs. They were the last three executions under the presidency of Donald Trump, which occurred in a lame duck period, which I didn't know what that was, so I googled it.
That's when there's a president elect.
Yes. It's when elected official who has an successor that's already been elected or will be soon. The official is often seen as having less influence with other politicians due to the limited time left in office. However, a lame duck is free to make decisions that exercise the standard powers with little fear of consequence, such as issuing executive orders, pardons, or other controversial edicts, such as executions.
I think Trump pardoned 11 people the day of inauguration.
He pardoned so many people his last days. I think it was a lot more than that. I saw like something said like 41 people.
Damn.
Like, it was, yeah, a large number.
I know he cleared a bunch of people who, like, committed fraud and shit related to him. Like, Steve Bannon and another guy who, like, did some sort of scam.
Right. With,
like, fundraiser money or something. But then also random people like Lil Wayne and, like, Kodak Black. Just, like, random rappers.
Yeah, no, it was a very strange last day in office for that man. But...
yeah.
Fitting that's how he ends his presidency.
Glad that bitch gone.
Me too.
All I can say.
But on that note, we shall take a quick break.
Yes. Okay, we are back.
My brain was immediately ready to go into the second episode that we're recording tonight, and I like completely bypassed the fact that you were like haven't started talking and telling yours yet.
We are still feeling, I thought I would feel more sad in the first half of this episode, but I really just got like impassioned. I was like, I'm gonna fucking burn down
the government. Nope, not that. Nope.
That's why I stopped talking, because I was like, no, I'm not getting investigated by the FBI today. I love you, Joe Biden. I would never burn down your government. Actually, I don't know how I feel about Joe Biden. Right now, I'm like, I love you, King, because like,
it's just a waking up from a nightmare, But like realistically, he is not this progressive man like that we wanted. But
I voted for Bernie.
I did as well, and it didn't work out.
And life is a disappointment. It's fine.
There is no longer.
Did you see the JoJo Siwa came out?
I did. Didn't I text you about it?
Did you? I texted like 4 people about it because I was like, oh my god, I'm obsessed with the new timeline that we are living in right now.
I was like, I saw the TikTok video that she posted and she was just like, you know, just lip syncing along to Lady Gaga. And I was like, okay, bitch, me too.
She posted like a picture of herself in like a rainbow Gucci sweater.
Yeah, and then she posted a shirt being like, my cousin got me this really cute shirt and it said best gay cousin ever.
I feel like, this is my theory, I feel like she kept trying to, like, come out, but, like, then her comments were still, like, I don't get it, what does this mean? So she was, like, oh, so she tried to, like, make it, she posted, like, Lady Gaga, and then people were, like, OMG, I also love Lady Gaga, and she was, like, no, I'm gay, and then she was, like, okay, fine, rainbow sweater, and then they were, like, love your sweater, and she was, like, no, I'm gay, so then she posted the gay cousin one, and people are still, like, wait, I don't get it, is she gay? I feel like she's at home like, oh my god.
Some of the comments are like, stop trying to like put her in this gay box that she obviously doesn't want to go in.
That she literally is like best gay cousin ever. And they're like, this doesn't mean that she's gay.
That means she likes t-shirts.
Yeah.
Anyway, on...
She's literally like retweeting other people being like, "This, you're doing so much good for the LGBT community," and people are still like, she hasn't said that she's gay.
And like retweeting all these like other queer people who were like commending her for coming out, and they're like, she still hasn't come out yet, guys. We're jumping the gun a little here.
I know, it's like, oh my, like she's literally gonna, like, in a year she'll be like posting pictures with her girlfriend and people will be like, oh my god, gal pals, love it,
they're such good friends. That's what Stevie's grandmother calls me.
That you're Stevie's good friend.
We're just good friends.
Ooh.
We're just really, really good friends.
I love when I get engaged and buy a house with my best friend, like, it's so fun.
Just friend things.
Just girly things.
On that note, shall we jump into your execution? Not your, you're not.
Yeah, let's fucking go.
If you can't tell, we are recording at the end of the week. And I feel like I give this disclaimer each week, but I just feel like it needs mentioning that our brains are just puddles of goo.
I feel like every time we record an episode, we're like, please don't get mad at anything we say. We are just little idiots.
That's our new disclaimer from now on. Please don't be mad at us. We're stupid.
Yeah. Sorry. No thoughts. Head empty.
This is truly just two people having a conversation, but on the internet.
I forget this mic is here regularly.
Oh, same. Like, I have, like, hit it with my hand many a time that I've had to edit out because I'm just, like, not thinking about it, and I just, like, punch it. Not, like...
So.
Not, like, Kyle punch it, you know? But punch it nonetheless.
I can't believe you've done this.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Oh, no, no, no. Ow. Okay.
Anyway.
Is it time for me to get executed?
No. Oh, my God. We're going to have to, like, cut all of this out.
It also was not time for George to get executed. Let's talk about it. So, I'm talking about a wrongful execution. This is an execution that just, like, fucking should not have happened. And I'm mad just thinking about it. So let's go.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So, George Junius Stinney Jr., he was born on October 21st, 1929, and he lived in Alkaloo, South Carolina, with his father, George Stinney Sr., his mother, Amy, and he had 2 brothers and 2 sisters who he also lived with. So, Stinney's father worked at the town sawmill. This was, like, Alkaloo was a like working class sawmill town, and the family lived in company housing, so the sawmill like had houses for all of its employees to live in. As I said, it was this small town, and it had segregated neighborhoods that were separated by train tracks. So, like, one half of the town is where the white people lived, and the other half of the town on the other side of the tracks is where the black community lived. The town also had segregated schools and churches, so there's very limited interaction between the black half of the town and the white half.
I hate this a lot already.
I also, so our story takes place on March 23rd, 1944, when George Stinney Jr. was 14 years old. So on that day, the bodies of two white girls, 11-year-old Betty June Binnaker and 7-year-old Mary Tame, or Mary Emma Thames, were discovered in a ditch on the black side of the town. So it's a very, like, sad story just off the bat. Obviously, we have an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old that are both murdered, seemingly. So the girls had gone out bike riding the previous afternoon, and they crossed to the other side of the railroad tracks because they were looking for flowers. But then they never returned home that night. So there was a search party for the girls on both sides of the town, and George Stinney Sr. actually participated in the search party. When they found both girls in this ditch, like 100, 200 yards from where the Stinneys lived, both girls had suffered blunt force trauma to the face and head, and it was guessed to be from a piece of railroad spike or some, like, iron rod, but reports differed as to what kind of weapon would have been used. According to a report by the medical examiner, the girls both had head wounds that seemed to be, quote, inflicted by a blunt instrument with a round head similar to a hammer. And both girls' skulls were punctured, like, with, they had holes in their skulls, basically. The medical examiner reported no evidence of sexual assault on the younger girl. The older girl had slight bruising, like, on her legs and around her genitals, but the medical examiner was unable to determine if that was due to sexual assault or something else. So the last known people to see the girls before they disappeared that afternoon were George Stinney Jr. and his younger sister, Amy. The girls had passed the Stinney's house the previous afternoon, and they asked George and Amy if they knew where to find these flowers that were called Maypops. So according to George's sister, Amy, George was still at home with her at the time that the investigators say this murder took place. However, George and his older brother John were arrested on suspicion of murdering the girls. John was released, but then George was held by the police. So keep in mind this whole story, he is 14 years old. He was not allowed to see his parents while being held at all, and he was questioned by Deputy H.S. Newman, who then put out this statement after just like a few hours of questioning him. Or maybe it wasn't a few hours. I didn't get the exact amount of time that he was questioning him, but he was the only person who was questioned aside from his brother for the crime. So the deputy put out the statement saying, quote, "I arrested a boy by the name of George Stinney. He then made a confession and told me where to find a piece of iron about 15 inches where he said he put it in a ditch about 6 feet from the bicycle. However, there was never a signed confession form," which when someone confesses, they usually make them, they like write out all the details that the person says about the confession and then make them sign it. That didn't exist in this case. So there was never the signed confession. And the 14-year-old later claimed that the officers starved him and they refused to give him food unless he confessed. So obviously that's a coerced confession. So, the only other quote, like big, giant, bold quotes, evidence that they had was that George was reported to have gotten into fights at school, according to his seventh grade teacher, including a fight where he scratched a girl with a knife. However, this wasn't even reported until 1995, 51 years after the crimes even happened, at which point it was disputed by everyone in the Stinney family, basically being like, that never happened. So it was probably like his teacher just being like, I'm gonna get my name in the newspaper or something.
I'm gonna be relevant again.
Yeah, I mean, like, not trying to, like, be like, you're a liar. Like, obviously, like, all evidence should come forward. But, like, why are you just saying this in 95 when the crime happened in 1944? Just seems sus to me.
Just a little bit.
Also, A local white woman claimed in 2014 that he had threatened to kill her and her friend the day before the murders. But again, this happened in 2014, so even later. And it wasn't even said until something significant happened in 2014 that we'll find out about later. But yeah, the both of those comments about him were made way later. And it kind of just makes me be like, well, why wouldn't you say something at the time of the actual investigation?
But because it's not true.
I mean, yeah, so those all came out like literally 50 years after the original trial. However, so following George's arrest, his father was fired from his job at the sawmill. So the family had to vacate their home because it was owned by the sawmill. And then the family basically lived completely in fear of being lynched by people in the town, and they weren't able to see George again until after the trial. So from the point he was arrested until the trial, they were not able to see him. So he had, from the time that he was detained by police, he had no support or contact with anyone that he knew for 81 days.
This is a 14-year-old boy.
Yeah. He was detained at a jail in Columbia, which was 50 miles away from where his family lived. And the whole time that he was questioned by police, he was alone. He didn't have his parents or an attorney.
That's also, I mean, it may not have been then, but like, isn't it illegal to question a minor without a guardian present?
It was, they said that it was a violation of his Sixth Amendment rights, but they also said that there was a Supreme Court case in 1963 that made it so like you have to have like you have to be basically he was 14, so he didn't know that he had the right to an attorney.
Oh, so is it now that
you have, I believe, to be now told? They have to offer it.
Yeah.
But I don't want to say that for sure because I don't want I don't want us to be called unresearched again.
Wouldn't want that.
So even though he was held for 81 days since his arrest, questioning, waiting for trial, his entire trial, including the jury selection, literally took one day. Yeah. Stinney's court-appointed counsel was a man named Charles Plowden, who was a tax commissioner campaigning for election to local office. I'm like, literally, was he an attorney? I don't know. Mans was a tax collector or a tax commissioner, so if he was an attorney, he was not practicing. And Plowden did not question the police officers who testified that Stinney confessed to the murder, even though it was literally the only piece of evidence that the prosecution had against him. He also didn't challenge the prosecution's presentation of two differing versions of Stinney's verbal confession. So they literally said in court that he confessed, but they changed their story. In one version of the alleged confession, they said that one of the girls had fallen into the ditch and they, and he like went in to help them and they attacked him. So, like, he killed them in self-defense. That was their one version of the confession. In the other version of the confession, they said that George followed the girls after they were at his, like, by his house. And then he attacked Mary Emma first and then Betty June.
And did they ever find the alleged, like, railroad spike that he said where it was hidden?
They said they did, but it wasn't, like, submitted as evidence. They said, like, in his confession that he... Like, literally, it was, like, this plays out like a freaking, like, kids pretending to play court, not, like, an actual court case. So, overall, there was no physical evidence linking him to the murders, there was no written record of a confession, and the deputies who said they got a confession out of him changed their story in the middle of the trial. Other than the testimony of the officers, the prosecutors called three witnesses. Those witnesses were Reverend Francis Batson, who was the one who discovered the bodies, and then the two doctors who performed the autopsies. And the court actually allowed discussion of the possibility of rape for one of the victims, even though the medical examiner's report literally didn't support this, and the medical examiner stated that the bruising found on Betty June could have been caused by a number of things, including extensive bike riding, which we know that she was literally bike riding before this all happened. Like, she was bike riding all day.
This is pissing me off. Like, this is making me so angry. And I get it happened in the 40s, but, like,
I'm angry. You should still be mad about it. Like, it's fucked up. Stinney's representative, on the other hand, didn't call any witnesses, did not cross-examine the prosecution's witnesses at all. Like, one of the things that the lawyer is supposed to do is cross-examine, and he just didn't do it. And he literally didn't even offer a defense. The trial lasted 2.5 hours. The whole trial.
For the murder of 2 girls, 2.5 hours.
Yeah. Because literally the fucking defense was just like, yeah, whatever.
I'm just like, here to get reelected, like, or to get elected. I don't know what I'm doing.
That's why I'm literally, like, earlier when I was saying, like, I feel like in my story the defense was, like, sabotaging. Like, how are you going to be someone's defense and literally just not even do defense? Anything. Like, he didn't cross-examine any of the witnesses. He didn't call his own witnesses. He didn't bring any evidence. He didn't, like, what did he do? Did he just sit there?
Just, no questions, Your Honor.
That's why I'm like, maybe he literally was like, okay, I want to get reelected. I'm going to get this kid the worst defense possible so I can get reelected by all the freaking racists in town.
This anyway. Makes me angry, and I know it gets worse because I know it ends with an execution, and it just... Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fun. This is also fucked up. You're gonna get so mad. So there were over 1,000 people at the trial, like, watching it happen. They were all white because it was a segregated town and black people weren't allowed in the courtroom, so none of George's family was allowed to be there. Sometimes you just, like, yeah, that, so that's the worst. Actually, it's not even the worst, because as you said, this ends in an execution. So Stinney was also tried before an all-white jury at the time, because black Southern Americans often were barred from voting, and therefore they were also barred from serving on juries, because voter suppression was a big thing in the South. I mean, it still is, but especially at the time. And the jury deliberated for less than 10 minutes before finding Stinney guilty of both murders. Less than 10 minutes.
I mean, all of those reasons alone, he should have been allowed a completely different trial. Like,
exactly.
So many different variables in this trial are just so unfair and, like, truly a miscarriage of justice. And, like, obviously, I don't know the entire details of, like, what led up to his execution and, like, appeals processes and everything, because we haven't gotten there yet, but I will hold my peace until we get there, and if it goes bad, I will have a lot more to say.
You're gonna, like, actually explode.
Great.
So, after he was found guilty of both murders, Judge Philip H. Stoll sentenced him to death by electrocution. There is no transcript of the trial, and Stinney's counsel never filed an appeal for him. Stinney's family, his church, and the NAACP appealed to the governor at the time, who was Olin D. Johnston, for clemency, given the fact that George was literally 14 years old. They were like, hey, maybe don't kill a 14-year-old. This literally made me be like, I'm about to beat this bitch up. Governor Johnston wrote in a response to the clemency request, quote, "It may be interesting for you to know that Stinney killed the smaller girl to rape the larger one. Then he killed the larger girl and raped her dead body. 20 minutes later, he returned and attempted to rape her again, but her body was too cold. All of this he admitted himself." Despite the fact that he admitted literally none of that, there was no evidence of any of that, and that's not even the story that the prosecution told on the stand. The governor just said that.
There's, and how can they, like, higher courts are just like, okay, this is fine. Well, I guess at the time, I mean, and even well, still now, just, the judicial system was so, like.
Well, that was his response when, because you know how, like, the governor, the president can grant people clemency?
Right.
That was his response when people were asking him to grant clemency. He was like, actually, I'm not going to, because this is what happened. And it's like, that didn't happen. What are you fucking talking about?
Like, that's a fucking wrongful death suit.
For real. And also, the family, George's parents, were only allowed to see him once between his arrest and execution. They were there for his execution, but before that, they were only allowed to see him one time. And, yeah, under... They were basically, like, being threatened to be lynched if they, like, tried to see him.
Jesus Christ. Also, just small side note, my air conditioning just turned on, even though we turned it off. So if you hear something in the background, it's that. And I am very sorry. I don't know how to turn it off properly. Okay, cool. It just turned off.
It's so. Okay. It'll... Oh, I was gonna be like, maybe it'll, like, mask the sound of us both, like, angrily...
huffing.
Yeah. This is, like, the saddest sentence in the world, so I'm sorry, but we're just going to have to get through it. At only 5'1", 90 pounds, and 14 years old, Stinney was killed on June 16th, 1944 at 7:30 p.m. I literally was about to cry when I read this. He was prepared for execution by electric chair, and they actually had to make him sit on a Bible as a booster seat because he was too small for the chair. His father was only allowed to approach the electric chair to say his final words to his son. And when George was asked if he had any official last words, he just shook his head and he didn't say anything because he was crying too much. And then as he was being killed, the mask that they have on the victims fell off because, again, it was too small, or it was too big for him. Like, he was too small to fit in this chair. He was, like, a little boy. He was 5'1".
This breaks my heart. Like, truly. I was, like, reading it makes me so angry.
I'm, like, tearing up. I was reading it this morning, and Alex came in, and I was like, I don't know what you're gonna say to me, but I, like, need a second. Because I'm, like, fucked up over this.
And just the fact that it happened so quickly, like, I know it was still, what, 3 years difference? Or, no, not even. It was, like, a few months different.
It was...
Because it happened in 44.
The girls were murdered in March, and he was killed in June.
That's 2 months.
Three, but yeah.
Math.
No, I feel you.
But... And now it takes 10, 15 years.
Yeah. It's a very racist town, obviously. Yeah.
I mean, no wonder that he wasn't able to go through an actual appeals process. He wasn't given the time.
Yeah. And this just, like, makes it even worse. His family didn't have very much money. So he ended up being buried in an unmarked grave in Crowley, Louisiana, which is, like, in a completely different state to where he lived. I don't know how or why he ended up in Crowley, Louisiana. But, yeah. Fucked up. But we have some... I was gonna say good news, but it's not really good news. We can kind of... There's some light in it. So in 2004, so we're jumping a little bit, a man named George Frierson, who was a local historian who grew up in Alkaloo, started researching this case after he, like, read about it in an old article. And he was researching and doing all this work, and eventually he actually gained, like, a large group of people who were contributing. They did countless hours of research and, like, reviewing historical documents. And they ended up finding enough new evidence and witnesses to reopen the case on October 25th, 2013, with Mackenzie and Burgess, along with attorney Ray Chandler, representing Stinney's family. Frierson stated in interviews that there had been, this is, like, fucked up, because I was reading these articles, and, like, a lot of people knew about this and just didn't say anything. There was a deathbed confession by a wealthy white man named George Burke, who had lived in the town, and members of his family, including his father, served on the jury that found George Stinney guilty. And I was reading these articles, like, I read this one that was written by this woman who, her grandma or her mom was a classmate of the girls that got murdered. And she said that her grandfather grew up and was there at this time. And she said that she heard from him. He was like, that kid didn't do it. And she was like, well, why didn't anybody do anything? And he was just like, it was just a different time. Like, people just didn't interfere and that kind of stuff. And so she actually, I think she was like a journalist or writer or something. And she went back to the town and was like interviewing a bunch of people about it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were saying kind of something along the lines of, not really like directly saying it, but alluding to the fact that it was this guy in this very wealthy family, and that like a lot of people knew that he did it, but like nobody said anything, because it's like a very like hush hush, like basically like let the fucking little black kid take the fall for it kind of thing.
That's horrible.
Yeah. So that's the theory, that there was this deathbed confession by George Burke, and that a lot of people kind of said that. And the new evidence in the court hearing also included the testimony by George's siblings that he was with them at the time of the murder, which wasn't allowed in, that alibi wasn't allowed in the case at the time.
Right, right.
Because they were like, well, they're lying. Which is a great defense, guys.
Well, not to mention the fact that the town was segregated, so his family wasn't even allowed in the to like watch the proceedings, much less alone participate in them.
Yeah. This one also like fucks me up. They had an affidavit from Reverend Francis Batson, who, as I said before, was the one who found the bodies of the girls and pulled them out of the ditch. In his statement, he said there was not much blood in or around the ditch, despite the fact that both of them had puncture wounds to the head. So this suggests that they were probably killed somewhere else and then taken to the ditch posthumously.
Right.
And doesn't it kind of make sense that if you're a wealthy white person and you're gonna, or not even wealthy, just a white person, and you live in this segregated town and you kill two girls, like, maybe you're going to dump their bodies on the other side of the tracks?
Not only that, if there was puncture wounds in their head, where was his bloody clothes? He would have been covered in blood.
Exactly.
Especially if he raped him, as they tried to say he did.
And he just did it, like, outside, near where people lived, and nobody heard anything, nobody saw anything.
Right, like, if the bodies were found, like, close by their house,
mm-hmm.
Somebody would have heard some sort of screaming or something. It's not like these two girls just died completely quietly.
Yeah, but the police didn't investigate anything, so we don't have any information about that, I guess. So there's also this man named Wilford Johnny Hunter, who was in prison at the same time that Stinney was, and he testified that George had told him he'd been forced to confess, and that, you know, they had starved him and not allowed him to eat unless he confessed. And he said that he was in prison for only 3 months, but the whole time he maintained his innocence. And then this is kind of the little bit of good from this story. So on December 17th, 2014, the like petition to reopen the case, because they had all this new evidence, was presented, and Judge Carmen Mullen actually dismissed the idea of a new trial altogether and instead just vacated Stinney's conviction. Like, she got it and was basically like, we don't need to do a trial. Like, she basically, what's the word? She just like cleared his conviction.
Yeah.
She ruled that he'd not received a fair trial. He was not effectively defended, and that his Sixth Amendment rights had been violated. This ruling was a rare use of the legal remedy known as quorum nobis, which is a legal order in some states that allows a court to correct its original judgment upon discovery of a fundamental error that did not appear in the records of the original judgment's proceedings and would have prevented the judgment from being pronounced.
Like, you know, everything?
Yeah, so, like, the whole case?
Literally, like, every single part of the trial?
Yeah.
Evidence?
Yeah.
A confession?
Mullen, for real. Judge Mullen, she ruled that his confession was likely coerced and thus inadmissible. She also found that the execution of a 14-year-old constituted cruel and unusual punishment, and that his attorney failed to call exculpating witnesses or to preserve his right to an appeal.
Yeah, then I feel like that attorney should face some sort of fucking repercussions for that shit. Like, that's...
For real, like, how can you be an attorney and just, like, be the worst attorney on the planet?
And it makes you think that, like, if it really was this, like, wealthy white man who did this, they could have very easily just been paying everyone off to get it over quickly.
Yeah, for real.
Like, that happens still now.
Yeah.
Much less alone in the fucking 40s when it's not as easy to keep record of everything.
And when it's a segregated town, a lot of people are racist, and it's just easy to pin it on, like, a black kid who did nothing wrong.
And it's just, Mullen, it's sad because this is fucking 70 years ago, and it's still just as fucking prevalent.
Yeah. Mullen also stated that Stinney may have committed the crime, but even if he had, no one can justify a 14-year-old child being charged, tried, convicted, and executed in 80 days.
Yeah, no, that's...
It all happened in 80 days.
That's the, like, most extreme part of it, is, like, in a span of 3 months. Less than 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Literally, even if he did do it, like...
Not to mention the fact, like, nowadays, anyone under the age of 18, they don't even usually get tried as an adult. I mean, in cases of, like, extreme crimes, they do, but, like...
Mm-hmm. Would you like to know my hot take?
I would love to know your heart.
I feel like, you know how that when, if a kid commits, like, a very violent crime or something, honestly, not even if they commit a violent crime. I've heard it happening for, like, even crimes that aren't violent, like drugs or whatever. But, like, if a kid is, like, a teenager, they'll, like, do a trial to try them as an adult.
Right.
I feel like that should be very rare. Like, I feel like maybe if the kid is 17 when they commit the crime.
Right, you know, like, just under the age of 18.
Yeah, but, like, I hear about it happening with, like, you know the Slender Man killings where the two girls, like, killed their friend?
Yeah.
I think they were tried as adults, and they were 12 when it happened. Like, I feel like even if the person does a horrendous crime, you can't try them as an adult because they are not an adult.
And, like, even at the age of 12 or 14 or even 15 or 16, they don't have, like, a full understanding of everything sometimes, you know? And well, so to, like, expect them to, like, understand the full gravity of their actions, especially, like, an 11 or 12 year old, like...
Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, like, the fact that they did... I think people just don't want to, like, accept that kids can do horrible things. So they're like, if a kid does do a horrible thing,
it must be the exception.
Because, like, I think they want to look at them as adults. They don't want to look at them as children. But the fact of the matter is they are children. And they should be treated as children.
Like, yes, this child committed a horrible act, but that doesn't change the fact that they are still a child.
Yeah. So it's like, even, like, I don't think Stinney did it because there's zero fucking evidence. But even if he fucking did, like, he still deserves a fair trial. He still deserves to have rights.
Fuck, he deserved a trial, period, because that wasn't a trial. Yeah, he didn't get a trial.
For real.
He was convicted before he even, like, got picked up by the cops. Like, they made a profile that fit him, gave him his story, changed his story multiple times, even after the fact. And it's like,
nobody even cared what the actual story was.
No, they just were like, he's to blame. We all know he's to blame. Who cares how he did it? Who cares if he did it? He's to blame.
Mm-hmm. I did get to kind of read. They did an interview with George's sister, Amy, when they called her when the case got, when he got found, like, posthumously not guilty.
Yeah.
And they called her, and she was, like, crying and being like, George is cleared, like, his name is cleared. And, like, even though, like, obviously, like, small victories, but, like...
And it's also just sad because, like, it's easier to think of this as, like, super long time ago and everything, but the people it affects are still alive.
Yeah. Actually, I have one more thing kind of about that. This is sort of when I was talking earlier about how I don't understand why families sometimes seem like they would rather just have someone convicted rather than the person who did it.
Mm-hmm.
Because when, you know, the case got dismissed, family members of both Betty June and Mary Emma, so the girls who were killed, both were, like, expressing disappointment with the fact that the case was dismissed. Because they all still said that they believed that George Stinney was guilty. A niece of one of the girls, so it was one of the sister's kids. So she never met her aunt, but mm-hmm. she said that she received a call from one of the officers that arrested Stinney in the 90s. And he told her, "Don't you ever believe that boy didn't kill your aunt." And this is, I find this actually kind of hilarious. They said that they believe that the deathbed confession of George Burke was unsubstantiated. I literally wrote LMAO in my notes after that because, like, are you gonna even, like, pretend that George Stinney's confession was substantiated?
It's just, like, this whole fucking trial is just infuriating, and I'm glad his family got the closure they deserved with this case, but I mean, what they really deserved was their son not to be put to death at 14 years old.
He shouldn't have even been involved in any of this.
No, he just had the, like, misfortune of being one of the last people to see them alive. That doesn't mean he did anything.
Yeah.
Like, nothing else points to it being him. And the whole point of a jury is you find them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. If there is a reasonable doubt, then they're not guilty.
And, like, here, I'm like, how is there, like, there's nothing but doubt. What are you talking about?
Like, even in cases where you're like, I'm pretty sure he did it, but the defense's case wasn't strong enough for me to be like, yeah, no, he definitely did it.
The idea that it's beyond a reasonable doubt is expecting that everyone will have some level of reasonable doubt. And I feel like in this case, it was like no one had any doubt. They were just like, of course this kid did it. And it was like, even though there's no evidence, he literally was coerced to confess. It doesn't make any fucking sense. There's,
I mean, no motive. You have a, like, deliberation for 10 minutes. What do you even talk about in that time?
Is there enough time to sit down?
Yeah, that's not even enough time to start discussing any evidence that's been produced. And I mean, while the only evidence that was produced was from the prosecution, that doesn't mean it was, like, sound evidence or evidence that had any merit whatsoever in any courtroom.
Yeah, it's like they heard the police officers get on the stand, change the confession twice, and then they went back there and said, yeah, he did it. Like, I just, like, I can't even wrap my head around it. It's so, like, fucked up. But I am glad that he was at least able to be cleared. I know, like, it doesn't do much for him, but at least...
But at least now public record will match what
happened. Like, what it should have been from the beginning.
Right, exactly. Like, that trial is a horrible, horrible example of our judicial system. It's nice to see that at least the judges that came after attempt to rectify the decisions that their predecessors made as best as they can.
Exactly. I'm, like, so glad that the judge who got the case was like, this literally doesn't even need a retrial.
Right, this doesn't even warrant a trial. Like, this shouldn't have been a conviction in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, but it just goes back again to the fact that it was a segregated America, and mm-hmm. everyone was racist. And, I mean, people are still racist to this day. Most of them are. And there was just that implicit bias that...
And there are still people who think he did it.
Yeah. Because it's just easier for them to believe that this small... little black kid did this when nothing points to him doing it. Not a single shred of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Because that story is easier to believe.
Like, sometimes you see, like, kids that are, like, 14, 15, and they're, like, tall and big. He was literally not. He was not even 100 pounds. He was 5'1".
Like, he was a scrawny, tiny little thing.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact, like, he... overpowered two girls. Like, I get one of them was 7, but one of them was 11. Like, she wasn't much younger than him. And yeah, with and him being on the scrawnier side. And they had bikes.
Yeah, and, like, so you're telling me that he killed both of them and then put their body, like, was able to pick up both of their bodies and, like, put it in it. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. And, like, it made me so mad. I was, like, fuming this morning, and now I'm fuming again. But, yeah, we did say that this was going to be a sad episode, but I do think it's important to talk about because, I don't know, I think the death penalty is, like, a difficult issue because obviously you never want to imply that, you know, the victims aren't important or that the victims don't deserve justice. They do, obviously, but I guess it comes down to the question of what is justice.
I personally feel like the death penalty in and of itself is just an outdated relic of an older judicial system, and it just really doesn't have any place in our modern, like, courtroom.
Yeah, I agree.
Because even in cases where, you know, the evidence is stacked against someone, evidence can be painted a certain way. We can introduce evidence. We can find things to make a person fit this piece, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it just comes to having to accept that the judicial system isn't perfect. Therefore, there shouldn't be an absolute,
yeah,
sort of conviction. Because, like, yeah, if they're sentenced to life in prison and then they die in prison before, like, you know, and then later it comes out that, oh, they were actually innocent, that's still just as horrible. However, it's not this absolute conviction that there's no hope in fixing and, like, coming back from.
Yeah, and it's, like, that's the thing is, like, obviously, wrongful convictions are a little bit less common now because of DNA evidence and stuff, but it still happens. It still happens pretty regularly. I actually watched, have you seen, like, any of Anthony Padilla's YouTube videos?
Not the recent ones, no.
Recently he does this thing where he, like, interviews people who, like, all have a certain thing. So, like, he'll do, like, I interviewed people with dissociative identity disorder. I interviewed people
I've seen them advertised, yeah. I've just not ever had the time to, like, watch, like, a 40-minute video
with him. He did one recently where he interviewed people who were sentenced to death and then later were proved innocent and got off of death row. And it's a really interesting video for anybody who is interested in that kind of thing.
I've been recently watching the confession tapes on Netflix.
I was just about to say, that's crazy.
And there's one case in particular that I think I want to cover at some point, so I'm not going to go super in detail.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, this woman was fed bit by bit how she allegedly killed her daughter. All while saying, I don't think I did it. Like, I don't think so. Like, basically, they were spending this entire time making her doubt herself. Making her believe that possibly she did it while she was in, like, in a dreamlike state or in a trance.
Mm-hmm. That's also the thing with, have you seen the Amanda Knox documentary?
Bits and pieces of it, but not all of it. I know the gist of her story. Like, she's the one, wasn't she the one who, like, allegedly killed her roommate?
Yeah.
And,
but she was found innocent, so.
Right, exactly. Eventually. Not allegedly, so she didn't. And, I mean, that one still has a lot of controversy around it, because there are still so many people who believe that she did, but
there was literally no evidence, and she confessed, giant air quotes, maybe I'll cover this one because I'm so passionate about it, but she confessed to it under the premises of she was in Italy, she was doing, like, a semester abroad thing in Italy, she barely spoke Italian, she only spoke a little bit, and she was being questioned in Italian. The officers were physically abusing her, they were hitting her, and they had kept her up all night, they wouldn't let her eat, they wouldn't let her sleep, and they were convincing her that she was crazy.
Maybe week after next, we do false confessionals. Because I think
that'd be cool.
I think that'd be a good one to cover. Because also, it's just kind of, like, it's true crimey, but also just very important to talk about because it's something that still is happening, regularly happening. And it's important to talk about and note because we need to be paying attention.
Yeah. Well, on that fun note, shall we sign off for the night?
I think we shall. We will let you ponder what we have discussed this week. Process. And we will be back next system. Week for something a lot more lighthearted.
Yes.
And it'll be a good time. So, until then.
Stay spooky, y'all.
Bye.